when we are raised up in consciousness, we realize that the same flow of intelligence and power and everything that makes up me is also in you, is also in this table, it's also in this floor, the ceiling, the atmosphere, and everywhere that we look. And this is the realization. And when we reconnect with that, that is entering back into heaven. That heaven is a state of consciousness. In order to do that, initially we have to break the spell of multiplicity, of duality, of separation. And to do that, we have to turn inside. And so there's this whole support for going inside, for getting peaceful, for getting still. If we're always involved in activity, that's difficult to do. We tend to just keep creating what we've already created. And so to break that spell, we have to cut ourselves off from all the things that convince the mind of separation. And initially we do that through the senses, by closing our eyes, by going into meditation and getting deeply withdrawn. And then inwardly, it's on the thought level. And these thoughts constantly are going through our mind that we become habituated to. And so then we have to break it on that level. And when we do that, then spirit is spontaneously and automatically revealed within us. And this is the great illumination. Now, sometimes people get glimpses of that. They get lifted up beyond any reason to their own knowing, or because they've been meditating or doing some spiritual practice, but suddenly they get a revelation. But that's really just the beginning. It's not the end. Then begins the real work, and it is dissecting, and using the intellect to cut away, cut away, cut away. And this is not this, not that. And until we get into that wholeness, that completeness. And so that is the work that we do on a yoni level, using the intellect for that purpose. And then all paths really lead to the same way. If it's the bhakti, then it's developing a sense of love, a sense of compassion, a sense of yearning for that truth, for that realization. If it's karma yoga, karma means action. And if it's karma, then it's developing a sense of always working, always in activity, but within that activity, always feeling like there's but one life, one intelligence flowing through you, animating you, doing everything through you. And so that that can also break the spell. And so the fundamental teachings around that are what Mother used to say is keep your mind on God. That's just, it can all kind of be succinctly put into that. And if you do that one thing, however you do that, and it doesn't have to be the name God, it can be something else, but it's that light, it's that higher intelligence, it's that omniscience, omnipresence. And when we put our mind on that and constantly raise the consciousness to that, constantly be lifting ourselves up to that, it begins to purify the mind of this illusion of separation. When we have that, then we don't need the outer support any longer, because the reversal of current has occurred and is rising up through the spine. And so the outer forms, the ceremonies, the time in solitude and quiet, it can be there or not be there. It doesn't make any difference, because that union with the omniscient spirit is intact. And that's how we were meant to enjoy this life. We were meant to enjoy this physical existence, but we were not meant to get so sucked into it that we believed it was our all in all. So, in the Old Testament, it describes it as the serpent tempting, and it's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And that's duality. And when we bite into that fruit, then we believe in separation. There's good, there's bad, there's God, there's non-God, there's high, there's low. And rather than seeing it all as part of the omniscient spirit, we become convinced that there's this separation. And so that's the fall of man. And it's not, you know, it's talked about in picturesque language. And so it said that God punishes or God judges. It's not that. It's that there's a law of cause and effect. And if you move into this realm and direct all your life energies down into the body and out, then the higher consciousness becomes dormant. And you fall from that Garden of Eden. What did Adam and Eve have there? They had continuous communion with God. They always saw God. Suddenly, they were trying to escape God. They were trying to go away from it. It got polarized. And he said, okay, you're now subject to death. What is that? That's attachment to the body. The body dies. And since we believe we're the body, then we believe that we die. And you have to earn your living by the sweat of your brow. What is that? You believe that you're the body, so everything has to come with effort through the body. And you are no longer connected with that omnipotent power that we are all connected with and a part of. And so just kind of the dominoes all fell. And once we became completely convinced that, all right, I'm the body, that's what I am, then that separation was complete. Not truly complete, but as far as the conscious mind is concerned, it's complete. The fun of it is that there's no separation. And so it's like having a dream that we dreamed one time of a nightmare, and we woke up and we go, oh, it's just a dream. Great. And when we wake up from this dream, we go, oh, you know, there is no separation. It's just a dream. It's just this state that I got into, and I came to believe it. And I went through, you know, 5,000 incarnations thinking that way, but it's over. It's okay. That's not really true. Boy, I believed that for a long time. Wasn't that strange? And then if we're really crazy, we say, let's do it again. Have you ever been through a horrible experience? I've been river rafting a couple of times. And in Washington State, we have the Metal River, which is pretty class 4 rapids. It's pretty stiff stuff. When you're in the middle of it, you always think, oh, I paid money to do this? What am I doing? How come I'm in the middle of this powerful water and being out of control and all of this kind of stuff, you know? And then you get done with it, and you go, that's next year? We'll do it again? Okay. Back we go, you know? It's how we are. I think the total insanity is we pay good money to go to movies to watch these disaster things. You were talking about the seeing this stuff on television at first and kind of look like a movie or something. We actually pay money to go and be scared to death or to see some kind of tragedy or, you know, tears are coming down our eyes and we paid for that, you know, that's entertainment. I think that's an excellent analogy for what brings us here. We are experience junkies. We want to be here for the experience of coming into duality and what is that like and what can we learn from that and how do we grow and all of that. And so this is a giant film. It's a stage. And we're all here learning and having experiences. And even though we complain about it, on some deep level, it's what we really want. And when we really don't want that anymore, we don't have it. When we really want to wake up. But you see, most people enter onto a spiritual path and they kind of dabble a little bit, or they go so far and then they get They go back, you know, and it's back and forth, back and forth. They're not really ready to give it up. Kind of, especially when we're miserable, you know, when we're really miserable, we go, man, I want out of here. And so we make some spiritual effort, or we go into prayer, and then God answers our prayer, and then we're feeling better, and we go, well, it's not so bad, you know, and back we go right into the world again. So it really is a product of what we want. And it really is determining what's really important to us. And that ego of separation really does believe that if we eliminate that idea of separation, we come to a standstill. We no longer exist. Life is no longer fun, interesting, anything, even though this omniscient consciousness is responsible for everything that's here. We've convinced ourselves that the game is up if the ego disappears and we have that oneness again. And how can that be? How can that be? So Mother used to say that God is life and life is God. All of it. And she also used to say, when you're in business with God, you're in business with all of life.
Desiring a piece of cake to, I think we're all guilty of, well, if I buy this, I'll feel better, and then you realize that, and then you can just keep buying and buying, and that's not going to be the answer.
Desire nature in and of itself is not the problem. Obviously, God has desires. And this is an expression of it, this material world that we're in. It is the belief that fulfillment of desires will bring us some lasting happiness. And so it's putting it into the proper perspective. What will this desire really get me? And if we are totally invested in this body, if I get money, if I get position, if I achieve something of what I'm wanting, then I will be happy. But you know, it doesn't take much to look around and see what worldly experience really does. We get something and we're happy with it for a little while, and then we're off to the next thing. Or we spend all of our time yearning for something that may never come to pass. So by using our intellect and saying, you know, that desire will not bring me lasting, real happiness, then we give it its proper perspective. And that attachment that says, this will be my fulfillment, we can break that. So if you have a desire for a chocolate cake, can you never be realized? And that would be a very simplistic kind of thing to say, and not true. In fact, my guru is fully realized, love chocolate cake. And ice cream sundaes, and life, all of life. But the difference was is that she is no longer living in a separated state of consciousness. And it is, again, that mental construct that says, my fulfillment of my desires will lead to my ultimate happiness. And it's really breaking that. And to do that, we have to have the willingness to let go of everything. We have to have the willingness to surrender everything, to cut everything out of our life. We can't hold on to even one iota of it, not just one ounce of it, nothing. And when we do that, then everything that we really want and need spontaneously flows to us. It's just this remarkable paradox. And the feeling of need for things is not paramount. We feel desire naturally flow through us, but it doesn't dominate us. So that letting go has to be complete. It has to be as if I'm ready and willing to let everything go. But what we find when we go through that is that everything naturally and spontaneously comes to us. So we have to have that willingness. And it can't be fake. It can't be kind of, well, can I get around this in a little way, you know, or can I cheat somehow? You know, it has to be sincere. It has to be complete. And so that is part of the spiritual path. But Mother never taught a path of sackcloth and ashes. You know, it wasn't, you don't have to go out to a cave and live in that cave and deny yourself everything of life. It's really cultivating an inner attitude. It's cultivating an inner awareness that, you know, even if I get this perfect job, even if I get this perfect husband or wife or whatever the situation is, that's not going to be my ultimate happiness. I know it's not. It can have some happiness to it. That's all right. But for every happiness, there's also a pain. For every gain, there's also a loss. To cultivate that equanimity of mind. And so that whatever comes to us in life, we take coolly, smoothly. Where if good health comes, fine. If we have some pain, all right. We either endure it or we rise above it. If lots of abundance comes to us, wonderful. If we seem to be struggling financially or in other ways, all right, I'll keep working with this and I'll keep cultivating a positive attitude about things. But it doesn't dominate my moods. It doesn't dominate my thinking. It doesn't tell me that I'm impoverished, even though my outward circumstances may lead me to think so. I don't accept it. I don't accept it. It does not define me. And so things that come to us, we take as information, but not definition. It does not define me. And if you've ever seen or read about or seen a depiction of somebody who perhaps was in impoverished circumstances, but they had a nobility about them, the way they carried themselves, the way that they entered into the world, and you really admire that person, really, and you can tell it's like they're a queen or a king when they enter in, not because of anything that they have, but because of who they are. And when we know that inwardly, then we're never impoverished. Because we don't accept that idea. We rise above it. And so when we know that we are that child of the infinite, there's nothing about outward circumstances that could convince us any differently. We're always that. And that's real freedom. That's bliss. That's joy. Peace. That surpasses all understanding because it's not based on worldly considerations. It's rooted inside of us. And when we have that, then we know that we have entered into that inner paradise. And it's our true nature is spontaneous joy, love, bliss, inner direction of wisdom and intelligence that reveals an inner light that goes beyond our intellect and our intellectual understanding. And when we have that, we know that we have God. And that He has us. And that is what all the great masters say is our true purpose for being in this life. Everything else is a charade. A distraction. And it doesn't mean in and of itself it's bad or wrong or evil. It's just as long as it distracts us from the true purpose in life, then to that degree it becomes a problem for us. But once we eliminate that, then it's just the play. It's the fun. And life is vastly interesting and creative and varied. And when you see it in its true perspective, you see the infinite nature expressing itself through all of us. You know, who could think that you would take raw materials and create a room and furniture and art and everything that we have here? Who would think that by looking at trees and rocks and, you know, minerals in the earth, that we would create all of this? It's lovely. It's wonderful. And so we're meant to enjoy it, but not be defined by it. So there comes a point where what I think of as living from the outside in, which is what most people do, if I have the right things around me, if I own the right things, then that defines me and that lets me know that I'm okay or that I'm not okay if I don't have the right things around me. And when we live from the inside out, I have inward abundance and joy and love, and that naturally expresses itself out through me. And so somebody's worldly circumstance can look exactly the same, but the source of it, one is from the outside in. I have to have these things to let me know that I'm okay. The other is I feel great beauty inside of me, so I naturally want to express great beauty outside of me. And it doesn't define me, it's an expression of me. And that's a vast, vast difference. So it's another way of talking about how to enter into this world in a spiritual way and spiritualizing this world. And that is the bhakti way, the all-embracing way. Creation is not an illusion. Creation is an expression of the infinite. And I don't have to go away from the world. I can actually embrace the world. But my knowledge of what the source is, I know it's not in these outer things. I know it's something inside. And so while I can appreciate all of this as an expression, I know that I don't mistake the gift for the giver. And when I don't do that, then I put myself in proper relationship with life.
Without a religious thought, or, for example, I was reading someone describing the class in Vancouver, and she says, I don't allow anyone to chant or any of that nonsense.
Yeah. Well, you know, Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, he said that however people worship me in lower forms and higher forms, with high intelligence, with low intelligence, anything that's given with sincerity, I accept. So if in our ignorance we look at some lower expression of God, and we can look around at everyone in life, and what is their God? In other words, what is their highest light? That becomes their God. And that may be no God at all in their mind. That's just perhaps justice in the world, or, you know, some other kind of measurement. And that is, if they're sincere in that, and they're yearning and striving to live a better life, then that's acceptable. In other words, that leads towards your advancement. For another person to enter into that same stage of worship would be a block, would be a degradation, because they're capable of something higher. So when you see everybody entering into living their life in a better way, I think an easy measurement is, are they living up to their highest light? Or are they letting some fear or some dogma or some belief system keep them limited? And if that's the case, then they are retarding their progress. But if they're sincerely and truly living up to the highest light that they know, then they are making progress. And in that way, there's no, if somebody's following some orthodox belief, but that represents their highest light, and they're very sincere, and they're working at it. God bless them. I mean, that is, they are right where they ought to be. And if I can use my parents as an example, they don't have much of a spiritual impulse in them. It's not something they came with. They are what I call C&E people, Christmas and Easter. They go to church, you know, and they kind of cover their bets. And actually, they've kind of done a little bit more in their later years, you know, because you see the grim reaper coming and you want to cover your bets even a little bit better. So, you know, but I think that they've made great progress because they've lived life with integrity. They've lived it with a lot of fullness. They've gone through ups and downs, but they've really striven to be the best people they know how to be. And I think that that's perfectly acceptable to God in the sense that that represents their highest evolution in that stage. Now, for somebody else who has a stronger spiritual impulse, but because of fear or because they think that people might criticize them or whatever reason, and they keep themselves in a lower stage, then that retards their progress. It looks identical for both people, what they're doing. And yet for one person, it represents their highest light. For another person, it's retarding their progress. So for that person that you mentioned, you would have to look into her heart and see, is she not doing that because she's afraid of public criticism, or because she has operating out of some fear or some limitation, or does that represent her highest light? Usually people who are living up to their own highest light are not criticizing other people. You know, oh, we don't do that kind of nonsense. And that indicates some kind of, there's a tension there. You know, if it's, well, that's not what we do here. You know, our focus is different. It's over here. That represents a different relationship with it. Of course. That's
about Hindu.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And stop. Don't do any more yoga until you become enlightened, until you have all the figures of your house, until you've got the prayers just right. And don't charge money, and you're doing us a disservice. And so he stopped thinking.
Well, thinking isn't bad. One of the things you'll find in Hindu cultures is Brahmanic from the Brahmins. And it's very similar to the old traditional Judaism, which is, this is the letter of the law. This is how things work, and you better abide just like this. I met a man in Anandashram, in an ashram in the south of India. He was Hindu. He was a scholar. And he specialized in Jewish literature. And I thought, well, that's interesting. So we had some long conversations. He was an absolutely delightful man. And I said, well, what brought you to Jewish literature? He said, you know, one of the advantages that I think the Jews had was the diaspora, you know, that they were spread all over the world, that it forced things to break up for them and to question things and to re-examine things. He said the Brahmins in India have had this lock on society, and they've not had to do that in the same way. And so that really drew me, because I saw the parallels to the two. And I see some of the problems that we have here in India as being a result of too much, he didn't say it, but one way of saying it is inbreeding, you know, too much circular thinking, too much talking to people who say yes exactly to the same thing. And so there's not that new input, there's not that flow, you know, for, I don't know if it's still true, I think it's true in certain sects, but Brahmins, if they travel overseas, they're polluted. If they don't do things in a certain way, we traveled with a Brahmin when I was there, and somebody said, well, I'm kind of hungry, let's stop at a restaurant. We went for another hour, and he kept on, he wouldn't say directly, no, I don't think that's a good place, no, I don't think, but he wouldn't say why. And we finally ended up at a place, and I'm quite certain it was because he knew that Brahmins cooked there. And he knew that was there, but he wouldn't directly say it. And so we just kind of kept going and going and going on this trip. So, of course, if we're wedded to a form too much, and especially, you know, form can take us so far. And actually, when we're first starting into things, we need to know kind of what are the rules and what do I do and how do I progress and all of that. But when this meditation takes us up, then we enter into a new world, and it goes beyond spiritual law into a spontaneous flow of spirit. And as we do that more and more, we transcend the law and we go into this inner spiritual world. If we don't allow ourselves to do that, then we retard our own progress and other people around us. So for someone else to say, are you aware of this and this and this to you as a teacher? That can be a service. It can get you to think. But also to have somebody who's wedded to a form and say, if it's not looking exactly like this, if you don't say the formula of that prayer exactly right, then it's worthless. That kind of business. That's somebody who is not yet fully awakened to that inner flow of spirit. And you'll see that true spiritual masters oftentimes break the rules just to make that break for people who are following them, showing them that it's not the rule that's God. That becomes a false image that you look at. The danger in that, of course, is that people can start to try to break rules too soon. And an example that comes to mind is in a literature class that I was taking, a writing class, the professor made it very clear to me that I first had to learn the rules of English language before I could break them. You know? Once I knew them and I mastered them, then, as writers do, they can break the rules. But first you have to have self-mastery of the rules. So we do have to go through, we do have to learn the rules, we have to know, because they set a pattern in our mind that becomes very helpful to us. But also there comes a time when we can break the rules and we go beyond the rules. So if it drives you inside and you say, what is the truth here? What is the truth here? And you're willing to set aside all of your understanding, all of your beliefs, and everything about it. Go inside, become very still inside. Just ask the question, what is my truth? What is the truth here? And don't go over and over and over it with your own cognitive mind. Set that aside as much as you can. Become still inside. Ask the divine life, the divine intelligence within you. Reveal it to me. Is there a truth that he's bringing to me that I need to examine? Is this a test to somehow take me outside of myself and lose myself in form that doesn't really work or fit for me? And if we use it to examine and go inside and become still, then it fits in perfectly with our own sadhana, because that's what we're doing anyway. And so you use every circumstance in life to propel you in your own journey. And every challenge that comes up to you, you don't personalize it to that person. You take it immediately inside. What is the truth here? And as you do that, that becomes a well-worn path. And instead of getting into debate and arguments, and it's not this, but it's that, and you take it inside, and you say, what is the truth here? You are deepening your own spiritual understanding. You are progressing in your own growth. Sometimes people give us something, and there's a piece of truth to it, but there's a piece of falsehood in it, and so we learn to separate those things out. Sometimes it's totally false. Sometimes it's a great truth somebody has brought to us. And sometimes the people who upset us the most and disturb us the most are our greatest teachers, because it forces us inside. And whatever it is that they brought to us, whether it's true or untrue, doesn't make any difference from that standpoint. It's drawn us inside. It's made us stronger by going inside. And so we take everything that happens in life for our own spiritual good. And when we do that, we're not fighting life nearly so much. We're not getting disturbed with people nearly so much. We go, well, that's interesting. I wonder if that's true. And then everything's supporting us. Everything's helping us towards the goal, and we don't see opposition. Certainly it comes at us in a certain way, but we don't see it as opposing our true goal, which is realization. We actually see it as supporting us and lifting us up toward the true goal. It takes practice. You know, that doesn't happen all in a day. Look at how I grew. And the more and more we can get into real time with that, right in the moment, and know this person is God come to me in human form. I no longer personalize it. I lose my fear. And when I lose my fear, I'm so much better able to learn. I'm so much better able to listen inside. Fear drives me outside. It drives me into desperation. It drives me into separation. Trust and faith takes me inside. And even though when we don't know what the answers are, we trust that the answers will come inwardly as we turn inside. It makes all the difference in the world. And sometimes answers don't come right away, but that is an answer in itself. That means wait, be still. Time for action comes, when the time for knowledge comes, it'll be there. Not always on our clock. I think you're late. Welcome.
I made it.
Mm-hmm, you did. So did Selena. Hello. But you're always here.
Maybe what's the way to understand or to advance in the needing, wanting, given process, as in, I don't know, let's say I have 5 sweaters at home,
mm-hmm.
and I want one more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need it, but I want it.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it's of color or not fashion or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Then I go and go to the store and say, okay, I want this. Okay, I can afford it, I buy it.
Mm-hmm.
But then I come to my mind that there is people around me, and in my particular case, let's say relatives,
mm-hmm.
who need certain things.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I choose to buy my new sweater.
Mm-hmm.
And then I feel a bit guilty for it.
Really, this is so fundamental to our thought, but it was a teaching that came to me from Mother. And it's difficult for us to get, I think, because the material mind sees everything as a fixed amount. There's only so much in the world. And in economics, they call that, it's a fixed pie. The pie is only so big. It doesn't grow. It doesn't get any bigger. And if you have a little bit bigger slice of the pie, that means somebody else gets a little bit smaller slice of the pie because it's only so big. Okay? What Mother taught is that God is infinite. God created the world. Our potential is infinite. Therefore, the pie is not fixed. The pie can grow and does grow all the time. There's an interesting statistic that 100 years ago, it was not possible to grow as much food as we're growing today. Another thing is, turn of the century, 70% of the population lived in rural areas. Farmers growing things. 2% are farmers today. 2% in our North American continent are growing food enough for everybody in our countries of Canada and America, and they export lots and lots of more food than that. When you think that the pie is not fixed, that if somebody makes that pie grow, it benefits everybody. Everybody grows. So when you go and you buy that sweater, you're supporting the clerk you buy it from because it gives them a job. You support that store and so on. So you're supporting the things in general. I don't know how many sweaters you need, but at some point you're going to say, you know, I got too many sweaters, and my aunt or my cousin or somebody would really like this sweater. It's still a really nice sweater, but I don't wear it anymore. So it goes to them, and you send it to them. So they benefit. They grow from it. And so when we concentrate on bringing more abundance, more expansion into this world, then everybody can grow. Everybody can benefit. If we come in with the idea that there's only so much, then we limit this omnipotent force that can make that pie grow, and we actually limit the size of the pie through our own belief, through our own thought.
So, in wanting material needs, I mean material things beyond our needs, it's nothing wrong?
Well, That then goes, there's two parts to that question, which is, one is kind of the outward explanation that I just gave around a fixed pie or not. Then there's the other part, are you in harmony with yourself and with the highest light that you have? We are talking about living up to your highest light. And if you're in your heart of hearts saying, you know, I don't want or need this, I'm buying it out of some compulsion. Maybe I'm nervous or anxious, and instead of kind of dealing with that, I go shopping as a way of dealing with some anxiety or some fear. It doesn't have anything to do with clothes, but that's just something that soothes me. It satisfies me in some way. Then you could say that's not living up to your highest light. That then is retarding your progress rather than helping you grow. What you would perhaps more benefit from is doing something for somebody else by solving a problem that's making you anxious, by going into meditation and getting quiet inside and dealing with the internal anxiety that way rather than by dealing with it by going shopping instead. So there's two different parts to the question. One, does it harm other people? When other people are in need, does it harm them if I have more? And I would say no, it does not. In fact, as the pie grows and as people make the pie grow, then everybody benefits from that. The other is whether you're in harmony with yourself and living up to your highest light.
I understand that part, but I feel like, let's say when I was way younger, when I was a little girl, clothes were given to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That was really good.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would have no clothes.
Right.
Yet, many times I really long wish to have a new clothes instead of being second or third,
right,
or forehand thing, okay? So now when the example I give about the sweater, I couldn't say this out of compulsion because I don't go out shopping just for that, but
mm-hmm.
let's say that I go and I need to buy a book.
Mm-hmm.
And in my way to the book, I find the store and I
mm-hmm.
think, oh, great sweater. Oh, yes, I want it.
Mm-hmm.
I will buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And then my, I don't know, my reason of why would say me, okay, buy it, but don't buy it for you because you don't need it. Buy
mm-hmm.
it and give it away.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, no, I won't give it away.
Mm-hmm.
I for myself. So it's a
so you,
one,
yeah.
There.
And there's no outward right answer to that. There's no way to say, oh yes, in that kind of situation, we should always do A or B. We should buy it for somebody else or we should buy it for myself. What you have to do is go inside, and that's the harder work, and say, what is my highest light? What is my inner consciousness? What is?
I guess I know the answer.
Okay. And when we feel at peace with ourselves, but again, that shouldn't come out of guilt. Oh, I should never have anything new. I should never have anything nice. Not that. But when we feel at peace with ourselves, when we feel the flow of love come from ourselves, then we know we're in harmony with ourselves. And like you say, you already know the answer, so.
I know I felt that guilt too. It's like, I want this, it's pretty, I have to have it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a clothes horse. But when the Diabetes Foundation calls me or whatever.
You have lots of things to give to them.
They call me all the time.
Yeah.
I have more things. And,
sure.
And I think, well, I'm buying it, and then, you know, perhaps it sits in my closet. But after a while, everything gets recycled.
One thing that I did at one point is I gave myself a 24-hour rule. And that is, if it wasn't a common kind of buying some food or, you know, something like that, if it was a little more expensive item, or give it 24 hours. And how do I feel about it the next day? Full 24 hours go by. It is amazing how often, once I was away from that situation, once I thought about it, I go, you know, really wasn't a very good color for me. It didn't fit all that well. It just, I've already got, you know, 10 shirts that look like that anyway. You know, what do I need another one for? That it cut down on that kind of impulsiveness. And that's really good practice for going inside and getting that more intuitive kind of feel for, is this good? Is this right? Is this? But I also would say that this other teaching that Mother gave to me around the fixed pie versus the expanding pie. And you hear it a lot. Well, there's only so many resources in the world. There's only so much in the world. And if you have a little bit more, that means somebody else has less. There's a lot of psychology that's really put into that. And spiritually, it's a mind killer. It brings you, if you choose, and I've chosen to in the last several years, to live very simply. But that's not out of a belief that if I have another shirt, that means somebody else doesn't get a shirt. That's not what's driving that. It's because that's what my highest light, and actually lot of things feels like a burden to me now rather than a nice thing.
And no, I never felt like if I have more other wealth, we'll have less. I just feel like...
Well, you mentioned other people don't have...
Well, they already don't have.
Yeah.
It's not that if I have one more than other people, because whether I buy it or not, these other people end up not having it, okay? My feeling is that if I have more that I don't need, instead I have what I don't need, help out.
That's a personal kind of, that's a relationship with yourself versus a relationship with the world. And if you're out of harmony with yourself, then you can get into buying a lot of things that you don't need, and that's not good. That's not good, because you're out of harmony with yourself then. And that's a different issue as to whether other people have or don't have. That's really unrelated at that point. Yeah. But it took quite a while for me to... I really found out how embedded that is in my thinking. And I think a lot of our thinking is that the pie is only so big, and if I have more, somebody else has less. And, that's wonderful.
Why do I want
yeah.
more instead than want to give?
Yeah.
That's my feeling.
Yeah. And if you get joy from giving, then by all means give. Yeah.
I should feel better giving than getting what I don't need, you know.
Well, that's going inside, and that's asking the question and getting the answer. And for you or for anybody else, it's not necessarily a flat answer. It's in this moment what is drawing me, you know, for somebody to buy something that's really nice and they feel really good in it. Is really an uplifting kind of a thing. It represents something wonderful and beautiful in their own minds. And it's a fulfillment in a way. And so far from being something that's bad or wrong or I shouldn't have that, it's really of great benefit to them to have that. You know what I discovered? It kind of surprised me when I went to really simplifying. And I went from 2,000 square feet to 200 square feet. Narrow, small. And I discovered I needed to invest as much energy in letting things go as I put into attracting it and pulling it to me. And I had the belief, and it was just kind of under the conscious mind, that things should just kind of fall off. I don't want that anymore. It should just go away. And it didn't happen that way. I had to invest a lot of energy into getting rid of things. It's made me much more cautious about what I take in, what I accept, realizing that when it comes time to letting it go, it's an investment of myself to get rid of it. And that... far from kind of being jealous of what other people have, I think, oh, I don't want the responsibility. I don't want what that brings upon you. And it's different phases for all of us all the time. So it's not like that's a preferred way or that's the way we ought to be. For somebody else, having all the things is a fulfillment for them. And so that's perfect. It's perfect, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Simplicity. It's freeing. Yeah. 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 A lot less to dust.
Well, yeah.
A lot less. Yeah. Yeah. I did have something I wanted to announce tonight that I don't know who may have heard or not heard, or if anybody has heard. Al has heard because I announced it in Sunnyside this last weekend. But a change of my life is coming about. And when I told Jerry Trofimchuk, he said, "Oh, no, what is it this time?" But well, I'll give you the short story, the punchline, and then I'll give you a little bit of the story. But that Carla and I are to be married in December.
Whoa, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you.
In December.
Mm-hmm. That's the punchline. Yeah, and in Sunnyside, actually, I kind of went into detail about all the went in, and I'd be glad to talk about that. However, we have that videotaped, and if you'd like to hear the long version, you're welcome to watch that. But this last spring, and I don't remember exactly when, the inner prompting started coming, and I had pretty much assumed in my life that it would probably continue. I was not against marriage, but it was not anything that was a driving need or anything like that. I felt very happy with the life that I had. And so I first talked to Larry about it. And I said, "This is something that is coming to me. And what do you think?" And he was very enthusiastically for it. I said, "Well, that's interesting. That's interesting." So in kind of true Indian fashion, the next step was I went to an astrologer, somebody that Mother Hamilton had liked, Jerry Mackus. And we were lined up in the house of friendship, and we were lined up in the house of love, and she was highly enthusiastic about it. But the really very special moment that I had with her, and I'm doing all of this in silence. So the very special moment is she's sitting there, and she looks off to the side, and she just gets this beatific look on her face. She's an older woman, Jerry is, and not a beautiful woman, but she just gets this beautiful look on her face, and she says, "Mother is always with you, isn't she?" And I said, "Yes, she is." And so I thought, well, that's interesting. That was like another piece into the puzzle. It was a big decision, and it was not one I wanted to enter into lightly. I also did not want some kind of unconscious desire nature driving it, rather than we've been talking about intuition and how to identify intuition. So then I decided to write Swami Satchidananda. I said, "Mother always said to test every spirit that comes. And one of the ways is to ask a realized person about that. And so I have the most profound respect for you. And if you say no, I'll accept that as God's will, and that's it. And if you say yes, then I will accept that as this is a true prompting." So he wrote back a letter, and he started it and said, "It comes as a surprise, but..." And he went off and was just totally positive about the whole thing and gave a quote, a very lovely quote, supporting it from Swami Ramdas also, that there's nothing within marriage that inhibits realization of God. So I still had some reservation. And I think for me and for many of us who have followed more Eastern teachings, there is this little bit of inborn bias around that renunciation, swamihood, things like that is a little higher than... We say that householder is okay, but, you know, there's this nod of the head that, you know, if you live this renunciant life, that's a little bit better. It's a little bit superior. So I think I was wrestling with that in myself a little bit. And the truth, and I wanted to know the truth. I wanted removal doubts. And I had this experience when I was up at Cloud Mountain and in the Hermitage Cabin that still resonates in me. It's very profound. And as I was sitting meditating in my chair, I opened my eyes. I had the sense somebody was out on the porch. And with my eyes open, with my inner vision, I saw Mother on the outside of the window there. And I closed my eyes, and when I opened my eyes again, she was still there. And she came in to the cabin and indicated there's somebody else with her. And then I closed my eyes. And there I saw these deer skin covered feet of this immense figure. These feet were huge. And all I could see were the feet. And somewhere beyond that was this immense figure. And I knew that it was Yogananda, but I couldn't see him. And Mother was focusing all my attention onto him. And I said, well, I can't see all of you. It's lovely to see your feet, but could you come in a form that I can actually see? So he shrank himself for my benefit to a size that I could see and comprehend. We had a long conversation, and I asked many questions about himself, about his life, about organizations, and many things. And then this idea of marriage came to my mind, and is this the right thing to do? And he was highly in favor of it, and he said that he had come and formed this organization because he had come to shift the consciousness of the Western world, and he has certainly done that with his writings and his teachings and everything he's done. But that had been fulfilled, and he wanted this householder yogi model that Lari Mahasya, the Babaji, had infused through Lari Mahasya and wanted to come and bring into the world, and he wanted that validated. He wanted that lifted up in the minds of people. And so he wanted that to happen. And that was the final thing that just kind of cleared all my doubts and all kind of any kind of question I might have had about it at all. And of course, Mother also was very much in favor, which she always was, of that. A very cute story. Mother had been ill for some time and was in her 80s. And she was talking to me one time and she said, you know, I've been wondering whether I'll get married again. And it's so cute. And Larry and I were talking about that. And he says, well, I wonder if she is preparing your mind for this time. Kind of giving it validation. And so we were talking about what do you have to do in terms of renunciation, and what is real renunciation, and going into the inner renunciation, and what inhibits knowing God and feeling the light and knowing the light. And that particularly for us in the Western world, but I think for those of India also, that this notion that you can't be in the world but not of it, that you can't lead what we think of as a normal existence and have God realization, that that's time for that to be, that illusion to be dispelled. So that's my announcement.
Where would you be married?
At the Unity Church where we had Kriya initiation. Larry, who's a minister, was made a minister by Mother.
Right.
Yeah. It'll be his first. yeah. It's fun.
And will we all be invited?
Yes.
I thought it was.
My mind gone.
yeah. It's a little bit of a struggle now because I thought, oh, that's that's where I would want it to happen. And I just found out that it only holds 75 to 80 people. So I was thinking more like 100 or 150. And okay, can we double stack chairs? Or you know, we'll figure it out. Yeah, but you're all. December 15th, which is a Saturday.
Yeah. This year?
Mm-hmm.
I'll still be here for it.
Yes. Yeah. So, from my viewpoint and from Carla's, it'll be a life of service. And, you know, that's both the center of our lives and... I think it'll be a great help to me, just in terms of the work. You know, she has a good organizing mind, and I think that that'll be very, very helpful to me. One time, Larry and I were accused of having an organization. I said, "You don't know Larry and I very well, do you? Neither one of us are organized. How can we have an organization?" You ever seen us organize anything? You'd be appalled. So Mother Hamilton had, when she gave me this work and made me a minister, she, part of my vow is not to have any organization. So no name, no organization, and not to charge for anything. It's all part of the... I think she made sure of that by giving both Larry, who is also a minister, from Mother and I, and myself, a very disorganized mind. Still, things get done.
Somehow, I'm uncomfortable with organization.
Yeah. The West tends towards organizing principle, and organizations and things tend to be in hierarchies, and things from the East tend to be always breaking down into smaller units. And in India, for instance, there's never been a pope, per se, for instance, no figure like that. It's more who, as an individual, do you have some faith or attraction to in terms of their teachings and that kind of thing. And then people are drawn to individuals rather than through organizations. And I asked Yogananda about that, because when he came, he formed an organization. And that was his response, was that it was needed for the kind of movement that he was injecting into the Western world, but that he was very happy to have this model where we meet in homes. There's no name. There's no outward organization. There's none of that that's involved. Focus is on realization. Focus is on God. And it leaves us very free. And I love it that way.
Mm-hmm. Feeling depressed or confused, and then I've realized that don't need to search outwardly.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful to meet and be with kind of people, but I think that sometimes that lot of organization and black or white and so stifling.
Mm-hmm. And it takes a tremendous amount of energy. You know, committees are formed, board of directors, the mortgage needs to be paid, you know, it just kind of, it takes on a life of its own, and it draws energy away from the real purpose for coming together. So, I think it's, well, this is the way that I've always been in terms of Mother's work, and it's just, feels natural to me. I wouldn't want it any other way. And it always has been, it always will be, fundamentally an individual path. You know, we go into the recesses of our own being, and we go inside, and we make that connection there. But we also have this power of association. And Indian word that's used for it is satsang. Sat is the eternal self, and sang is association. So we come together to support each other in that realization. And there is power, you know, there's a synchronicity, there's a kind of power that comes together through association that is different than being on our own. So to get the highest benefit of that without some of the detriments of actually drawing energy away from that for other kinds of activities. And we certainly try to have fun too. Because God is life and life is God. It's everything. So we have potlucks and joy and laughter. Sometimes people say, well, I wish we had more quiet. And some people say, I wish we had more social time together. But, you know, it is what it is. And it takes on its own life. But it's what each person brings. You know, each person brings the light of their own selves. And when that light is all combined, then it makes a really big light. Which reminds me, so tomorrow we're going to have a satsang
from
11
to
1. From 11 to 1. And it was something that is kind of a desire that was working in me at Cloud Mountain. And so it can be a time where we can sit together in silence, or if there's questions and we can do that. It's very, in my view, it's very open to what's in the moment. If you want to come for some of that time, but not all that time, that's all right too. So. You can come and go as you like. Should we do a little chanting? And then we'll close. Yes. We'll do that after the chanting. The style that I like is a I'll sing and you respond. Okay? Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ramo.
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 Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai.
Shri Rama Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Rama Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Rama Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Rama Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Rama Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram
Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Rama Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Rama Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Rama Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram
Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai
Shri Rama Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Rama Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Rama Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram 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 Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om. Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram Om.
Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram.
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 Shri Ram, Jai Ram.
Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram.
Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram.
Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram.
Shri Ram,
Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram.
Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai Ram.
Om Shri Ram, Jai Ram, Jai Jai. Mother translated that chant to mean victory to God, victory to God, or victory to the light. Let us stand. There are others who come to mind around needing healing alms. Elaine, this one.
Wendy Driever.
Honor.
Honor. Whether you know these individuals or not, in your soul, you are connected with them. Feeling your oneness with that infinite potential and power within you, let us send that out through these healing ohms in vibration of love, of health, of perfection, physically, mentally, and spiritually. Seated. Will you please pray with me? O Heavenly Father,
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence,
of Thy glorious presence
in every part of my being,
in every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for Thee.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at Thy feet.
And surrender myself to Thee.
And surrender myself to Thee.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
I feel the power of Thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence
are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the beauty and bliss.
My soul is filled with the beauty and bliss
of thy everlasting perfection.
Of thy everlasting perfection.
Pure light within you, ever guide you, ever comfort you, and lead you to your infinite home. Be it ever so.